Jungle Jam Podcast with Daniel Cleland and some other cool people who have really cool things to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Jungle Jam Podcast. This is Dan Cleland. I'm here with a couple of very interesting folks. Repeat guest, who you guys know as the freelance writer and now board member of Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, Guy Crittenden. And our primary guest today has not been on the podcast before. This is the founder of the Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, also known as ARC, which is a registered Canadian charity working in conservation in the Peruvian Amazon, Jana Bell.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me.
So let's first off give the listeners an idea of what ARC is doing down in Peru and how you came to be.
Okay. Well, I guess to go back to the very beginning, in 2011, a good friend of mine was celebrating a milestone birthday, and she wanted to do the Machu Picchu trek, and she invited me to come along. And I was looking at the map, and I saw that the Amazon rainforest was adjacent to Machu Picchu, so I said to her, we have to tack on a side trip to the Amazon rainforest. We will never be down here again. So we did the Machu Picchu trek. Then we did a three-day stay at an eco-lodge in the Amazon rainforest in Tambopata, which is southeastern Peru. And it was a fabulous 3 days, saw a lot of amazing things. And as I was driving home from Toronto's international airport, just an incredible, overwhelming feeling of sadness came over me. And I realized the jungle had such an impact on me. I hadn't realized it, and I just knew that I had to go back. So I went back 2 months later, but this time, instead of doing the touristy things, I was taken to see the realities of what was occurring in Tambopata, and the destruction to the rainforest was just unbelievable to see.
So are you talking about like clear-cutting destruction? Or were there ever other activities like the mining or?
Yeah, the main thing in Tambopata is the illegal gold mining. Now, originally, say even 10 years ago, Tambopata was a remote, sparsely inhabited region of the Amazon. It was unconnected to the rest of the world by road. So it was really quite a pristine area. But in 2011, there was a completion of the Interoceanic Highway. And this is, I think it's about almost 3,000 kilometer long highway, and it's from the Atlantic port in Brazil, and it goes, slices right through the Amazon rainforest to the Pacific port in Peru, and has opened up this whole area, which was once totally remote and inaccessible. Now, because of this highway, there's people flooding the area of Tambopata because there's gold dust in the banks of the river. And the price of gold had skyrocketed, I guess, in the past 15 years. So right now, I think they estimate there's probably about 30,000 illegal gold miners in Tambopata.
That's crazy.
And they are... it's incredible what they're doing. They're basically changing the landscape from a rainforest to a desert.
Now this, so you guys know this isn't, it's not even clear cutting, it's worse than clear cutting because they're first clear cutting the landscape and then going in and digging up the ground, sift the soil using heavy metals and stuff to pull the gold dust out of the soil, and then they discharge that wastewater into the landscape, the river system.
Exactly. And what they're using is mercury, and because mercury is really cheap And it's a simple way for the what happens when the miners. So we went and I saw the miners. He has a huge barrel. They've put in the barrel the sediment with the gold dust. Then he adds the mercury to it, and the mercury attracts the gold away from the sediments from the earth. So then the miners left with a chunk that's mercury and gold. So they dump the waste back into the water, but then they also burn that chunk, so then more mercury is evaporated into the environment. And so the miners themselves have direct contact with the mercury, which is really hazardous to your health. Basically, it's a slow, poisonous death.
Don't they like get in these barrels and stomp the sludge or slurry around? Or what did you see when you were there?
They stir it with their leg. So it's insane. And I asked this one particular miner who was stirring this whole toxic soup with his leg and eating his lunch at the same time. And I said, have you heard about the impact of mercury on human health? Are you concerned? And he said to me, yeah, we've heard about it, but I don't think it's true.
Yet there's all kinds of cases of people getting sick there, is there not?
Oh, it's going to reach a huge crisis, because now what's happened is a whole bunch of scientists from the Carnegie Institute have gone into Tambopata, and they've tested, first of all, they've tested the fish that's being sold in the markets, and the mercury in the fish is way over what's acceptable. And that's the main source of food is fish. So it's entered the food chain. And then they've also tested the residents. I mean, they've tested the miners themselves. Their mercury levels is way off the charts. But even the residents who live there and may not even live near a mining site, but are eating the fish, their mercury levels are insane.
One of the things that's worth noting is what happens is, to make matters worse, is that mercury evaporates up into the atmosphere, and it rains down, and it is there by the climate locally, transfers the mercury out of the place where it was originally mined. And so this is like the gift that keeps giving. It transfers the pollution to other areas. So you have whole areas of the Amazon that are devastated by this. And so you could be in, as you're saying, like in a village. I have a friend who has a retreat center that she operates not far from you, who you know. And her staff and people who lived in the local village all had very high levels of mercury in their blood. And they weren't fishing directly from the river, they weren't gold mining, but it's just in the whole food chain. So it's a major catastrophe, and not one that many people in North America know about.
Not just to analyze the health risks to the local population and wildlife, but this is so excessive that literally when you're flying from Cusco down into Puerto Maldonado in a jet that's, what, 5,000 feet in the air or something, 10,000 feet in the air, you're literally looking from the bird's eye view at the rainforest, and you can see these massive, it just looks like just massive scars on the forest, because there's literally nothing there. You've got this sea of green, like this carpet of green, and these huge swaths of just utter destruction. And it's just all, it looks like the Alberta tar sands in the middle of the Amazon. It's really, really disturbing.
Actually, now like there's so many gold mines down there, they can see them from space.
From space, is that
yep,
right?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
So where are these people coming from? Are they all Peruvians, or are they flocking in from Brazil or other countries?
Most of them are from the highlands in Peru, coming from really impoverished villages, but a lot of them are also coming from Brazil.
Right. I remember when I was down there, I did my very first retreat in Peru in Puerto Maldonado. I was there for a month, in and out. And I remember back in that at that time, that was also in 2011, there was a lot of political unrest around the miners. Like there were, it seemed like the government was trying to stop them, but you've got this huge, like 30,000 people segment of the population, and they have all these kinds of machineries. And the government at that time was like blowing up their mining machines and destroying their equipment, and there were protests. And so on the one hand, you've got all these impoverished people just trying to figure out a way to make a living. They're desperate. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the government that, I don't know if they're taking a cut from it or not, but they seem to be trying to protect the rainforest, but they're not doing a very good job. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting. There's, from my perspective, there's sort of two categories of these illegal gold miners. And the first category is sort of your small mom and pop family operations. They're just supplementing their income by mining gold and small scale production. They're still using mercury though. It's still causing environmental damage, but they're just trying to feed their families, send their kids to school. That's one category. The other category is the scarier category, and that's the large mining sites, the large illegal mining sites. And right near Puerto Maldonado, which is the main capital town, about an hour from there, there's a huge illegal mining site, and it's called La Pampa. And in 2012, the government did a raid on La Pampa, and they brought in the army, and they, as you said, they dynamited all the machineries, they burnt down the whole town. It was basically a shanty town made up of, you know, wood and tarp. But it's like a lawless zone. There's so much drugs and there's murders there every day and there's human trafficking. The miners will go to these impoverished villages and tell parents that their children will work in the restaurant of the mining camp and will send money home. So the parents let their children go, and once the children get to the mining camps, they're actually forced to work in brothels. So, really dangerous places. So back in 2012, the government came in and blew up La Pampa. And I was in Peru, I guess probably 6 weeks after the raid. So I thought, perfect opportunity to go in with my little video camera and do some videotaping of the environmental damage the miners had done. So we drove there and they were already started back up.
Is that right?
The miners were already there. And not only that, we had gone through some blockades of policemen. So either the policemen had been bribed or threatened. So, and now, the last time I was checked out La Pampa, because it fascinates me, it's too dangerous to actually go in, but I drive by it, and it's huge now. It's just huge. It's a huge, sprawling shanty town, and you can see all the machinery, and the government just doesn't A, have the resources, and B, there's a lot of corruption.
This, just hearing this makes me so upset. This is very close to my heart, this cause. And like, I was thinking, you know, the intro to this podcast, that Sepultura song, Ambush, screaming for more justice, Amazonia burns, can you hear them? That's like, I've been listening to Sepultura for like a dozen years, and that's what spawned my interest in like Brazil, the Amazon, the jungle. They were kind of like this Brazilian thrash metal band that was screaming about corporations destroying nature and all this kind of stuff. And like, if there was ever a time that intro is appropriate, it's for this episode.
Exactly.
And the outro as well. But so you got motivated to do something about it?
Yeah, when I came back from the second trip and I came home and I just felt an overwhelming responsibility that I had to do something. And so I was researching for a Canadian organization that was doing work in Tambopata, and I was having a hard time finding one. So I felt, okay, I have to start my own. And it actually took me 2 years to convince the Canadian government to issue ARC charitable status. It was the Harper government at the time, and the Harper government was not friendly toward issuing charitable status, period. And secondly, to an organization that was doing work outside of Canada, especially in a country like Peru, which is, you know...
Especially in conservation, because the Harper government was starkly against any type of conservation efforts whatsoever.
Exactly. And those were two long years, because I wasn't sure if I was going to be successful. But I ended up in 2014 getting the charitable status. And
so we better tell people exactly what it is that ARC does, now that we've depressed the hell out of everybody about how bad the situation is. Maybe, Jana, just tell folks, like, how you, like, raise money and buy land and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we've got sort of three main goals that we're working on right now. The first one, obviously, is to protect the environment by conserving ecosystems and biodiversity on a long-term basis. And that's where we go about acquiring land. So in 2014, thanks to our supporters, we were able to purchase the title of our first concession, which was 616 hectares. And this year, we, again, thanks to our supporters, we bought the neighboring property of 800 hectares. So now we have in total 1,416 hectares, which is about 3,500 acres. So a nice chunk of land, and it's pristine rainforest land. It's got a whole incredible flora and fauna. It's an area where there's a lot of Brazil nuts. Most of the people there all are Brazil nut harvesters. The issue is that the harvesters only get a fraction of the export value of the Brazil nuts. And so they need to supplement their income. And they're doing that by gold mining on their properties. So
on their own properties?
Yes, on their own properties.
Which are probably not titled to begin with.
Well, they're Brazil nut concessions.
Oh, I see.
So they're not supposed to be gold mining.
Right.
Just harvesting their Brazil nuts. But they're not bringing enough money.
But then when they start mining, is that not eating up some of the territory for the Brazil nuts? Like, because you're pretty much, you can mine the land once and then it's essentially,
you just keep moving on to, yeah, to a new part. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, is it possible to remediate the land after it's been mined for gold and contaminated with mercury?
That's what they're not sure about. And actually, we're in conversation with some researchers at one of the universities in Canada that are really interested in coming down to our site, because our second property, there was a small portion of it that was mined for gold. So they want to come down and they want to do some testing and see what can you do with these sites that have been contaminated? How can you clean them up? What is the best approach?
That's it's an interesting aspect. You know, in Canada, we tend to think of ourselves as the white knights around the world and peacekeepers. But one of the dirty little secrets of Canada, and I know this from my years editing trade magazines on pollution control, and we used to cover the mining sector, is that a lot of the head offices of some of the worst polluting mining companies in the world are based in Canada. So, you know, we may do this or that in Canada itself, but in other countries, the track record is a little sketchy. Conversely, though, Canadians have expertise in remediation of contaminated sites, and we have a very strong mining sector, and we do have expertise in that. So it's kind of a virtuous cycle in a way that perhaps Canadian technologies and American and European ones, but could be used to help rectify the situation down there. And, you know, then those technologies could be used elsewhere. So that's actually really encouraging, because I guess what I'm saying is we owe that to the planet in Canada. We're not quite as good as we think we are.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a capital intensive process though as well for any kind of government or mining agency to go down and commit to remediating damaged rainforest in Peru is probably not that realistic.
Yeah, right? It's a real challenge. The economics are going to be, I don't know, it's a tough one.
So the clearly the best strategy is conservation, right? Don't destroy it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so all of the drivers of deforestation, I mean, at least 90% are economically related. So you've got the people who live in those areas. I mean, you've got your foreign corporations as well coming in for, you know, to create palm oil plantations or soybean or what have
or
you.
Or buy the gold.
Or buy the gold.
They're the customers.
Yeah, absolutely. But largely it is the local populations who are living in those areas. It's almost like death by a thousand cuts because you've got all these mom and pop operations or ranchers who want, you know, or gold miners, loggers, trying to survive. They're not making a lot of money down there. I highly suspect that they're not, you know, saving big bank accounts by mining or by cutting down trees or by growing cattle. But it is nonetheless all economically related. So in order to conserve the forest, what do we need to do? My assumption is that it has to be something done working with local communities to provide them with a source of revenue, a source of activity, because you can't just tell people to stop doing, because people are going to do. People need to act. They need to have influence on their environment. You have to replace that with something.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that we're looking at is what other opportunities are there for the Brazilian harvesters where we are to supplement their income that's not gold mining. And one of the things that we are looking at right now is a possibility would be cacao. And as you know, it's the cacao pod which is used to make chocolate. And cacao can only grow in these humid jungle environments, and I think only within a certain area distance from the equator. So it's a small sort of area in the world where you can grow cacao. And they're not plantations because the cacao plants are pretty fragile and they need to be under the big canopy of the trees in the rainforest. So it's what we're doing right now is we're researching to see where we can get really high quality cacao seedlings, and then we'll sort of do some test plots on our conservation land and see if this is something that then we can help the communities. We can provide them with the seedlings, provide them with the training on how to farm the cacao sustainably.
And there's a big demand for cacao. Everyone,
especially organic cacao.
Yeah, like I know I have all these millennial friends and they're all into the cacao shapes. They put them in their smoothies. So it's not like Nestle chocolate. It's it's like this is a serious, I think it's a cancer fighting properties and all that kind of stuff, as well as energy. And just as an aside, I think we were talking one time about with Maria or someone about how the Brazil nut has some kind of chemical in it that is indicated as being anti-carcinogenic. So there may be a really interesting possibility not only to feed Brazil nut production into the, I don't know, whatever the nut food bulk barn market is, but also to develop the market for the Brazil nut as a medicine in the so-called first world and elsewhere. It's a very, very encouraging market that could be developed to add value. And maybe if the people can get involved in producing, processing the Brazil nuts into whatever format they would be used medicinally, that might allow them to make value added. Because it's all just to interrupt. People forget that with the Brundtland Commission back, I think it was 1990, they created the term sustainable development, and people have come to think of that as an environmental term, but it actually isn't. It was always an economic term. And the point of the Brundtland Commission was basically, hey, if you want to continue doing business on a planet with finite resources, but your economic model is limitless growth and you have a huge population boom, you're actually not going to be able to do that forever. So sustainability is really not just environmental. It's about figuring out how you can do business and have markets in perpetuity. And so I like what has been raised here about not just how to conserve the Amazon rainforest, but what economic systems can be brought to bear that are sustainable. So these people are not just told, you can't mine and their equipment's blown up, but what can be offered to them that they can support themselves in a sustainable way. And I think we have some ideas in that regard that we could get into.
I've got a crazy idea.
What?
We were talking about this earlier. So, and Guy, I've talked to you about this, the aquaponics system. So aquaponics is the integration of fish farming, which, closed systems aquaculture, and hydroponic agriculture. So essentially within this integrated system, you can produce clean protein and clean greens. It's basically a set of fish tanks that hold tilapia generally or other freshwater fish. The fish are fed, they excrete in the water. That water, which would otherwise be considered a toxin and filtered out of a fish farming system, if it was just fish farming, that water is then sent through a series of biological conversion processes, using like worms and microbial culture and soil and stuff like that. And then it goes through a series of hydroponic tubes. So you've got a system of tubes with holes in and plants. With plants growing out of the holes, the roots are dangling in the water. So the fertilized water from the fish tanks gets pumped through these hydroponic systems. The plants then absorb the nutrients from the water, and they grow. And in the process, they filter the water from those toxins from the fish excretion. So then that water gets pumped back into the fish tanks and it's clean, and it's like creating an ecosystem within a controlled environment. And the reason this is so catchy for me is that it's you can really put it anywhere. It's very efficient when it comes to utilizing space. So you've got a 1 acre parcel of land using aquaponics can produce as much food as a 20 acre parcel of land using traditional agriculture. And it provides good quality food, and it could be a sustainable economic model. I mean, it's taken off all over North America in cities where there's unused industrial space, warehouses, things like that. People are installing these large farms. In Toronto, there's a couple of examples. So they build these farms in unused space in the city. And then you've got agriculture right within the city. It is being served to all kinds of restaurants and local food buyers and organic markets and stuff like that.
So one of these things could be put on a piece of contaminated land that used to be used by the gold miners. Could allow them to make a living, and then they could feed the uncontaminated fish to the population that has been eating the mercury contaminated fish, right?
That's what I'm saying. And that's one application. But then, as we were talking about, the other drivers of deforestation, particularly in Brazil, is cattle ranching and like soybean production, crop production. So you've got some of the states in Brazil are almost completely denuded by these ranchers who are now have these expansive cattle ranches. The problem with deforesting the Amazon to grow crops is that most of the nutrients in the Amazon are stored within the jungle itself. So the leaves fall from the trees, they break down, and then are immediately used up by the roots of the trees to grow more trees. And when you take away those trees and that nutrient cycle from the ecosystem, the actual soil itself is not excessively fertile. So you might have a couple of years of crop production and that land is essentially dead. Then they put cattle on it, and that's kind of the way things go. And then they have to keep eating deeper and deeper into the jungle. So I think there might be, I mean, we can explore this idea based on your knowledge, Jana. But, I was really excited to talk to you about this because I wanted to bounce this off you and see what you thought. Mm-hmm. Because there's clearly going to be a lot of inherent obstacles to this. But, you know, I was thinking about how this could work on a large scale in these areas on the Amazon fringe that have been already devastated, not to mention preventing further devastation of the Amazon, but taking this model and somehow working with potentially governments or potentially investors, techno-philanthropist investors, or potentially these carbon credit consultants that you guys are working with to find funding to actually go down and install these aquaponics systems in communities around the Amazon on the fringe that are either slicing into the jungle or have already destroyed the jungle. And then potentially by providing them with a source of food and an economic opportunity for the communities to not only grow food for the community, but also grow food for sale to other people or for export potentially, to then give some of that land back to the forest. So then that might look like, trading land title for these large pasture lands, trading that land title back to the organizations or investors who are putting the aquaponic systems there in the first place. And then a few years down the track, you might have reforested land, which not only creates a buffer zone for between the people and the forest, but also an area for potentially sustainable forestry or potentially cacao plantations or something along those lines. What you're doing is just increasing the carbon intake of those pasture lands.
Okay, Dan, I'll buy one. I'm gonna get out my I'm sold. I'm gonna have my checkbook.
So what are the problems with that? What kind of obstacles are we gonna run into with that scenario?
Oh boy. Well, I guess getting buy-in from people down there that the system actually will work. Of course, investors is always getting money from is always so tricky, especially in Canada. I find people are very interested in supporting cancer research or anything to do with children. The environment doesn't seem to be so high on the agenda.
It's good that there's, you mentioned that there's actually units in operation up in North America, because the benefit of that is that then you can show the proven technology to the investor. And I think the challenge is going to be to build a demonstration one down in the Amazon so that the local officials can get excited about it and whatever red tape they would put up. I don't know, maybe it won't be so hard. Maybe you could just build one and it'd be so outside of people's, so outside the box thinking that it might not even be regulated. Maybe there isn't something that would stop you doing it. I don't know.
What is it powered by?
Well, I mean, when you're connected to the grid, obviously it would just be powered by the grid.
But yeah, if you're in the middle of the Amazon.
In the middle of the Amazon, yeah. Well,
solar
the two obvious choices would just be a simple gasoline generator or diesel generator.
Okay.
Or which was probably the cheapest and easiest to access for the people down there. It's usually what they use to power their homes when they're in remote areas, or solar power. So I think the critical factor there would be how much energy does it actually use. Now, in that area, like, okay, for example, when you're dealing with aquaculture in places like here, like in Toronto, you've got, in order to operate year round, you have to use indoor lighting to actually grow the plants. So that's a huge power draw. Now that's where you need to be connected to a grid that's supplied by nuclear or whatever.
Right.
In the Amazon, because there's sun all year long, you don't need to be powered by lights, so you actually would have a transparent or translucent greenhouse. So the plants would actually be under glass and therefore would not need indoor lighting. So the only power draw you'd have are the pumps that are moving the water around the system.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, feasibly, you could use solar power. You might get away with two or three kilowatts of solar panels to actually run the pumps in a system like
that. Yeah, you might just have diesel generators as backup or something. But, you know, as we all know, the price of solar has dropped precipitously. The batteries are getting better. The Tesla home battery is the most well-known one now. And effectively, solar power is now cheaper than fossil fuels, if not even including the subsidies that go to fossil fuels. So it's another matter to build out the infrastructure, but just comparing apples to apples, solar is now looking very inviting. This might be a good place for me to just comment on what we're looking at for carbon offsets.
Absolutely.
And I would immediately preface this by saying, you know, we're not there yet. It's just something we're exploring, but it's an interesting thing to think about, because again, we're thinking about economics. We all want to save the Amazon rainforest, but are there economic ways that can help supercharge this? And I think most people are at least vaguely familiar with the idea of carbon markets, and I won't get into a long explanation of it, but the gist is, if I'm a company in North America, and there's a price put on carbon, which is starting to happen in different provinces and states, I can actually get money for my company by reducing my emissions, my smokestack emissions and other carbon emissions. And so companies that can reduce their carbon emissions rapidly can actually sell those on a market. They're kind of traded on a Chicago type stock exchange. Anyway, speaking about the Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, one of the opportunities might be to have the project undergo some kind of audit so that it qualifies as a kind of carbon sink, so that North American and European and other companies can purchase, maybe they purchase land or somehow otherwise invest in ARC and receive carbon offsets for it. Now, one of the best examples that I've encountered, and we're just starting to talk to a consultant now, is airlines. Airlines are huge buyers of these carbon credits because they have no choice at this time but to burn fuel. And if they're not willing to do that, we wouldn't have planes in the sky. So, for example, United Airlines is purchasing credits in the Amazon to offset its emissions from all its planes. And one of their projects is somewhat similar to ours. It's a community in the Peruvian, I think it's the Peruvian rainforest. And normally these things work by, you get the offset in exchange for planting trees. This one, from what I've read, is interesting because they get the carbon credits just by entering into agreements with local people to adhere to a sustainability contract or a conservation contract. So it's things like not cutting down the trees, not doing illegal gold mining, you know, sending your kids to school. It's all this very practical stuff. And so I think the community benefits, money flows to the community, and the rainforest gets preserved, and this qualifies as an offset for United Airlines. There's a very interesting area. I don't want to say more than that about it right now, but we're looking at it, and this could allow us to maybe expand the ARC value proposition, maybe buy more land and keep it out of the hands of exploitation, and maybe do some of the kinds of projects that Dan's talking about, because I would think that an aquaculture aquaponics project might very well fit with that. In fact, I would almost guarantee it would.
Well, yeah, if you're talking about actually reclaiming, so if you could title the land in question and potentially title it to an organization like ARC. ARC then sells the carbon credits to the Canadian companies or American companies or European companies that are producing carbon through their business activities. And then ARC sets up some type of a management program, potentially working with the local communities to first give them a salary to go out and replant trees on that land, and then tend that land and ensure the trees grow and that it becomes a healthy forest. You know, you could not only provide those food production modules for them, but also pay them to help remediate the jungle around them. And I'm sure they'd be happy to do that. Like, I'm certain that people aren't cutting down the forest because they have no respect for the land. They're doing it out of desperation. I mean, we work very closely with Libertad Village down in Peru, with as Pulse Tours, and I know those people. I know they're poor. The only thing they have is the jungle around them. You know, they have to. It's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? They have to buy gasoline to power their chainsaw, to cut down trees, to sell trees, to buy more gasoline, to power their boats, to, you know, power their chainsaws, to cut down more trees.
Yeah.
And, you know, they it's not like they're out there clear cutting and exporting rainforest, but in order to live out there, in order to get food, they have to pull food out of the jungle, they have to fish, they have to kill monkeys and anteaters and capybaras and deer and crocodiles and stuff like that, and that's how they survive. And they do grow their chickens and their ducks and and that kind of thing. But if you were to offer them a way to provide sustenance for themselves, potentially earn a, like, they don't need money, they just, like, they're all they're concerned about is providing for the village, having building materials, having food for people, giving hope to the locals, you know,
exactly.
So they don't feel like they're impoverished. And
they just want a dignified life.
Yeah, and a happy life, and to live in communities with their families. And I mean, they're, if you just provided them with a model where they could get those basic necessities, make a little extra money, I think they'd be very receptive, and they'd be happy to watch the forest grow.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would really like that.
Mm-hmm.
So apropos of that, Janet, can you tell people a little bit about how to participate in ARC, what ARC does with money, like, what do you do in Canada? Give us a feeling for what's happening at this end, because I joined the board of ARC because I was enthusiastic about what you were doing. I traveled to Peru, and I came back and I felt I needed to do something more hands-on. I mean, there's only so many times I'm just going to click another petition online or something and think I'm making a difference. I wanted to do something that was like really, like, where one day I could get dirt under my fingernails and really make a difference, and I'm pretty keen on ARC for that reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I say, we're a new organization. We just received our charitable status in 2014. So starting up, most of our supporters have been friends and family.
We've had and Pulse Tours.
And Pulse Tours. And Pulse Tours. Yes, thank you very much. So now that we've kind of established, we have a really strong board of directors. We have our Peruvian sister organization called PARC, and it itself has a board of directors. We've hired an executive director who manages operations down in Peru. So we've accomplished a lot in 2 years. And now, as I say, we've got almost 3,500 acres of land in our protection. So we're feeling more comfortable now that we can actually go out and look to Canadian corporations to partnership with us, looking at potential grants. Because one of the things we really like to do is to build a biological station on one of the properties. So we can invite researchers and students from around the world to come to the Peruvian Amazon and do research projects, do educational projects, collaborations with all different countries. And we also really feel strongly that we want to use the biological station to really educate and strengthen the leadership of the Peruvian people to be guardians of the Amazon rainforest. That's sort of a key thing that I think is missing down there. There's been a lot, and I've talked to a lot of Peruvians down there who over, say, the past 20 years have said, we've seen, you know, this organization come in and then they leave, and then this organization comes in and they leave. And so the way we're unique down there is we are a team of not just Canadians, we're a team of Canadians and Peruvians.
Right.
So we're there for the long haul. We take a lot of our guidance from our people down who are living down there. So we really want to strengthen the Peruvian component of the people down there. Because that's really where the leadership should come from.
That's awesome. It's also worth mentioning, and I know this isn't specifically ARC's mandate, but I know Pulse Tours is involved in bringing a lot of people from technocratic societies, as I call them, down to the Amazon rainforest. Not only do you have down there this rich biodiversity, and the Amazon is the lungs of the earth and is going to be crucial in offsetting the effects of climate change, but you also have this very rich culture down there, not only the Spanish culture, but the Shipibo and the other cultures and languages and spiritual matrices of over 50 indigenous tribes, some of which are hanging on by their fingernails, some of which will probably, their language will go extinct within our lifetimes. But the more that we can preserve the habitat, the more we can preserve all the animals and birds and reptiles and insects that live on that habitat, but also we can help preserve these very ancient cultures with their shamanism, with their use of psychotropic plants. In other words, what I'm implying is, there'll be some people who will say that this kind of project has a kind of neo-colonial aspect, which I think you've addressed, because we're working with local people there. We're not coming down there saying that we know all the solutions and we're going to preach it to people. But we need, I think the first world, as we call ourselves, which is again a neo-colonial term, but in the developed world, we're the ones doing the major polluting around the world and destroying the planet. And not only do we have an obligation to preserve the rainforest, but we actually need the ancient knowledge and wisdom of these indigenous people. And I've been to, with Pulse Tours, to one of the retreat centers there, and I know Dan has built his own one, the Ayahuasca Adventure Center, and the shamans or curanderos down there, you know, they're waking up a huge number of people in the developed world to the sort of shamanic knowledge and ancient wisdom of these tribal people that we need. So I guess this is, in a way, going to help ARC a lot, because there's already a lot of North Americans and European people going to the Amazon and having this sort of Lonely Planet style travel. They're trekking in the Amazon, they're learning firsthand about the importance of it. Then they're maybe hanging out with these shamans and getting woken up to a bigger reality, sort of the Gaian mind. And so you're providing, ARC is providing a hands-on project to actually save the habitat for those cultures. So definitely worth mentioning. And I don't think it's an accident that the guy who started Pulse Tours is sitting here talking to the person who started ARC, because you're both engaged, all of us are engaged in different facets of really the same project, and we critically need it in the world at this time.
Cool. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up. Jana, I'm sure some of the very conscious, well-intentioned, and world-changing listeners of this podcast will want to, in some way, shape, or form, help your organization. And so how can they do that? What's the best way to help preserve the Amazon through ARC?
Well, I guess we have a website, AmazonRainforestConservancy.com, which has a lot of information about what we're doing. And through the website, you can contact me. You can make a donation. You can volunteer your time for projects, or whatever.
I think we'd be very interested also in hearing from any consultants or people with expertise in things like carbon offsets and stuff. I mean, we're a small organization, and there's going to be a cost to becoming a carbon offsetter. So anybody who can help give us some guidance about how to achieve that, we're very interested in information as well as money.
Cool. Absolutely. And I would welcome any comments on my the idea I'm toying with about bringing aquaculture to the Amazon. If any of you guys want to comment on that or share some knowledge that that you may have. So again, guys, if you want to donate to Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, you can find them at AmazonRainforestConservancy.com. It's an integral organization that's doing great work. I want to thank you, Jana, for coming down today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you again, Guy. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, that was fun, man.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's another episode of Jungle Jam Podcast, over and out. To save another day, some join us. It will make them live this way. When it goes down, when it goes down.